We appreciate your presence this morning. We trust that as we come together, that we come prayerfully, asking God to bless us as we come together. I hope that you will remember to pray that I'll be able to preach to His honor and to His praise, that we all will be able to hear in such a way that His name might be honored and glorified by our coming together. We're reading a lesson this morning in the Old Testament book of Numbers, chapter 13. And I would invite you to turn there in your Bible and follow along as we read a few verses that are there that we felt impressed to look at this morning. Numbers chapter 13. I want to begin by reading about three verses in the beginning of the chapter and then skip some verses that are rather dry reading and then look at a few verses that are further down. Numbers chapter 13, beginning at the first verse. And the Lord spake unto Moses, saying, Send thou men that they may search the land of Canaan, which I give unto the children of Israel. Of every tribe of their fathers shall ye send a man, every one a ruler among them. And Moses, by the commandment of the Lord, sent them from the wilderness of Paran. All those men were heads of the children of Israel. And then the verses, that's the first three verses in the chapter. And then verses 4 down through 16 is simply a list of the 12 tribes of Israel and the one man from each tribe that Moses selected to send. I'm going to stop right here and mention just a little bit about the context of the lesson so that we can get some idea about what the lesson is about. Israel was on their way from Egypt to the land of Canaan. They had been traveling, I'll say walking, for about 2 years. They'd gone in a very roundabout way. If we think in terms of modern day geography, they had crossed the Red Sea. It's generally thought that they had crossed the Red Sea, just a little neck of the Red Sea, that is in the area where today the Suez Canal has been dug. They crossed the Red Sea up there, and then if they had gone straight to Canaan, that was their destination. But if they had gone straight, it would not have been over, I'm guessing, 200 miles. You know, it was close enough that before the Israelites went to Egypt, they had traded back and forth. The famine that had come in all the world, the known world at that time, the famine that had come involved both Canaan and Egypt. But God had made provision that there was grain in Egypt. I'm going to mention that the Bible calls it corn. And the reason that the Bible calls it corn is that the language in the King James Bible is the language of England rather than the language of America. And the English, they used the word corn. We would use the word grain. See, we talk about grain, we talk about wheat or rye or oats or corn. You know, different species of grain. We call it grain, but the English called it corn. And so it's rendered corn in the King James Version of the Bible. But there was food, corn, grain in Egypt. There wasn't any in Canaan because the people in Canaan hadn't been warned that there was coming a famine so that they could make provision for it. God had blessed the Egyptians that they had food to eat in that famine. Jacob, the man who was called by the name Israel, but he was Abraham's grandson, Jacob. God changed his name to Israel. But he sent his sons to Egypt to buy some corn, some grain, some food. The point we were making was that it was close enough from Egypt to Canaan that they traded back and forth. Israel that lived in Canaan, they sent to Egypt to buy corn in two different trips doing that. So it would have been a matter, I'm guessing, 200 miles. Might have been a little more, might have been a little less. But that's about how far it was. If they had gone straight from Egypt, where they crossed the Red Sea, if they had gone straight to Canaan, I'm guessing 200 miles. So if they made 10 miles a day, which would not be an unreasonable amount, then 200 miles would be what, 20 days? So the trip would not have been very long, but God sent them in a different way. And they'd been traveling for about 2 years. They arrived in the southern end of the land of Canaan, and the three verses that we read mention that God told Moses to select a man from each of the 12 tribes to send those 12 men to go through the land and bring back word to them as they camped out here at the south side of the land, to bring them back word about the land. Now, beginning now at the 17th verse, and Moses sent them to spy out the land of Canaan, and said unto them, get you up this way southward, and go up into the mountain, and see the land, what it is, and the people that dwelleth therein, whether they be strong or weak, few or many, and what the land is that they dwell in, whether it be good or bad, and what cities they be that they dwell in, whether in tents or in strongholds. And what the land is, whether it be fat or lean, whether there be wood therein or not. And be ye of good courage, and bring of the fruit of the land. Now the time was the time of the first ripe grapes. So they went up and searched the land from the wilderness of Zin unto Rehob, as men come to Hamath. And they ascended by the south and came unto Hebron, where Ahiman, Shishai, and Talmai, the children of Anak, were. And then Moses puts in a word there that Hebron was built 7 years before Zoan in Egypt. And they came unto the brook of Eshcol, and cut down from thence a branch with one cluster of grapes, and they bare it between two upon a staff. And they brought of the pomegranates and of the figs. The place was called the brook Eshcol because of the cluster of grapes which the children of Israel cut down from thence. And they returned from searching of the land after 40 days. So Moses sent these 12 men to go through the land, and I'm going to read again what they were directed to be looking for. The first thing that he told them was to see the land what it is. Get some kind of a picture in your minds about the layout of the land. Is it mountainous or is it plains? You know, if it's mountainous, it might be suitable for flocks, but probably would not be suitable for row crops. On the other hand, if it's a plain, then we could be thinking in terms of having row crops rather than just pasture. So he told them to see the land, what it is. And then he told them to look in the land at the people of the land and to pay attention whether they were a strong people or a weak people, whether the population was sparse or whether it was, you know, a large number. And the next thing that they were to look for was what the land is that they dwell in, whether it be good or bad. You know, is it fertile? Or is it sand like it is down around Jacksonville? Down there, the topsoil is about 6 inches thick, and below that, it's just plain white sand. They were to bring back word as to what kind of land it was. To bring back word about the cities that they dwell in, and whether they were living in tents or whether they had permanent residences or not. And they were to bring back word about whether there was wood or whether there wasn't. You say, why look about that? Because wood was what they used for fuel. I think in modern day thinking, this would have been a scouting party to determine whether it was going to be hard to take possession of the land or whether it was going to be easy to take possession of the land. Of course, we know that, you know, from our knowledge of what took place later, that was an important question to the people. I've often wondered why God told Moses to send these men in the first place. God knew that when the 12 men came back, 10 of them were going to say that the people are so strong that we can't expect to go in and push them out and take over the land. But that 2 of them would say, God told me, God gave us the land, He'll bless us to do this. If we'll go depending on Him, it'll work out. And God knew that what the 10 people said would sway the congregation more than what the 2 people said. And God knew what was going to take place afterward. So wonder why God sent them into this land. Well, I think one reason that God sent them into the land to look at it was that God, knowing that they were going to rebel against going in and taking over the land, and God wanted to remove from their minds the idea, we didn't expect it to be this strong. That they knew the strength of the people that were already there. They knew that before they went, and of course they knew that, so they didn't go. They rebelled against God and wouldn't go. In other words, God was fixing it up so they didn't have any excuse. They were supposed to have gone knowing that it would be difficult, but go depending on God. That's what they were supposed to do. And we, as we live, we have the same situation. I remember many years ago, the Primitive Baptists had purchased a little piece of property down in Thomasville Plantation that they were going to use as a place to build a college. And I was talking with a man. See, I was young in the ministry at that time. Was talking with a man that was a member of another order, but his wife was a member of our church, and he came with her faithfully to church. And he expressed to me the futility of the weakest people in the world, Primitive Baptists, engaging in an operation that was going to be that big. And of course, his point was that we ought not even start it. Of course, there were those among us who said, if we go, this is of the Lord, and if we go depending on Him, He'll work it out. And there was so much of the opposite feeling evident among our people that God didn't bless the effort. But when we are swayed by the difficulty of doing a work, and a work that if we think about it, we'll know that it's of God, and if we're swayed by the difficulty of doing it, then we're going to fail. Those people, they were supposed to go in and take possession of the land, go in depending on God, and if they would go depending on God, God would work the situation out. Same way, if we depend on Him, things will work out. He'll work things out. On the other hand, if we try to do everything in our own strength, we're probably going to get discouraged like they did. But they were to look at the land and bring back word that had to do with the difficulty of going in and taking possession of that land. Now when they came back, those 12 men, well, the Bible mentions that at the particular time that they went through the land, that it was right in the time when grapes were starting to get ripe. And they found what to me seems like about the most prolific grapevines that I've ever heard of. I have looked at this lesson several times before. Most of the time when I would look at it, and I talk about the grapes that they brought back, that the bunches of grapes were so large that they took one bunch of grapes and slung it across a pole, and then two men picked up the pole and put it on their shoulders or brought it home, or brought it back to where the congregation was. They brought it back as an evidence of the fruitfulness of the land. That this is a land worth fighting for. It's a good land. And most of the time when I would preach about it, I would think in terms of 6 bunches of grapes, you know, because there were 12 men and it took 2 men to carry a bunch. So I said, well, that means then just 6 bunches of grapes. And I thought in terms of 6 bunches of grapes coming back. In reading this week, I was impressed by the 23rd verse. Talking about the 12 men as they went through the land. It says, and they came unto the brook of Eshcol and cut down from thence a branch with one cluster of grapes. And they bare, that's past tense of the word bear, carry, our word bore. And they bare it between 2 upon a staff, and they brought of the pomegranates and of the figs. And then again in the 24th verse, the place was called the brook Eshcol because of the cluster of grapes which the children of Israel cut down from thence. So that's clear that they only brought back one bunch of grapes. And usually when I would think about it in terms of 6 bunches of grapes, I would usually make the point, 6 bunches of grapes would not have gone very far among that group of people. And then I'd do some arithmetic. 2 years before that, when they came out of Egypt, they counted heads. They counted the men that were 20 years old and above. 19-year-olds didn't get counted. The women didn't get counted no matter what their age was. And the tribe of Levi didn't get counted. But those men that were counted, there were 603,550 of them. Now, if each one of those men were married and had a wife, you've got over 1 million people already. You know, just the husbands and wives, not counting any of the children. And if each family had 2 children, you end up to 2.5 million people. And 6 bunches of grapes, no matter how big they are, 6 bunches of grapes wouldn't go very far among that. It wouldn't be enough even for each person to have one little grape. You know, these grapes, they weren't supposed to be eaten. I'm sure they were. But that wasn't the purpose of their bringing them back. They were brought back that the people might see that this is a land worth fighting for. That it's a productive land. Now the lesson is about, you know, the gospel. Those 12 men went into the land and brought back word about the land. Paul said that he knew a man in Christ. And then he said, whether in the body, I don't know. Whether out of the body, I don't know. In other words, I don't know whether he's still living or not. It's been a long time ago since I knew him, so I don't know whether he's still living or not. But the Lord does. The Lord knows. This man that Paul knew had been lifted up into heaven, and there he had heard words that were, so I use the word profound, that he couldn't utter them when he came through the experience. Now I think that there is a sense in which the gospel minister gets a little look into heaven and comes back and tells us what he's seen. I think there has been a time or two that I felt that I had a little glimpse into heaven. As I tried to tell people about what I had seen in that little glimpse, I never felt that I got the idea across. But the gospel encourages us to look forward to that time when we'll be in heaven. Right here I'm reminded of Brother Leroy Devane, one of our preachers. I had the privilege of being his pastor during the end of his life. His wife, well, she had Alzheimer's, and it was back before people talked about too much about Alzheimer's, but that's what the problem was. And during the last several years of her life, she lived in a nursing home. Every day, whether it rained or not, Brother Vane would go to the nursing home sometime during the day and visit with her, his wife. She passed away, and for a while it looked like Brother Vane just didn't have anything to do, and he started talking about his being anxious for his life to end so he could go to heaven. Now he, in talking to me along that line, he never mentioned, I want to go to heaven because my wife is there. He wanted to go to heaven because he was beginning to look upon heaven as home. And he talked about his desire to be there to the point that his oldest daughter said, Daddy, when you talk like that, you make us feel like you just don't care anything about us. Well, of course, that wasn't what it was. It was just that he knew something better. But no matter how good it seems at the time, all we have is just a little foretaste. Think about an incident that's mentioned in another place in the Bible. David's grandfather was a man named Boaz. Boaz was in love with a young lady named Ruth. He had made up his mind that he wanted to marry her. Well, Boaz had, I believe it was a nephew, and the nephew had been married to Ruth, and the nephew died. And the practice in that society was, and it was God's rule, that if a husband died without leaving a son, that the nearest kinsman had the obligation to marry that widow and raise up children, not considered his children, but considered the children of her former husband. God made that provision so that they... Well, he made that provision so that the inheritance could be in the same family. In other words, this son, this husband that had died without leaving any sons, you know, in that society, daughters didn't get any inheritance. It was only the sons. And if he died without leaving a son, then that would mean then when his widow died, there's nobody to inherit the property. So this was the way that God worked it out so that there would be somebody to inherit that man's property. But the obligation for redemption was upon the nearest kinsman. Boaz loved Ruth. He wanted to marry her to raise up an heir for her former husband. But he was not the nearest kinsman. There was another one that was closer than he was. So Boaz went to see that man. Waited out by the gate of the city. In my imagination, I think that they had seats at the gate, you know, that people could sit in while they waited for somebody to come through the gate. And if they sat there long enough, the person they were waiting for would be bound to come through so they could meet the person that way. Boaz was waiting there at the gate, and this near kinsman came by, and Boaz said, "Come here, so I want to talk to you a minute." So he stopped. Boaz said, "Naomi," that was Ruth's mother-in-law, "Naomi's got a piece of property. She wants to sell it. You're the nearest kinsman. You can buy it." That nearest kinsman, he said, I'll buy it. And then Boaz said, "But there's a little catch. When you buy it from Naomi, you got to buy it from Ruth too. Ruth comes with it. And you've got to marry her and raise up children that are accounted as her first husband's children." And that nearest kinsman got thinking about it. He was about to get his own property confused, you know, by having these children that were really his but not counted as his. And so that nearest kinsman said, I don't want to redeem this property. Telling Boaz, "You can have the property." Because he knew, you know, Boaz was mentioning it because he was next in line. The Bible says in the account of that taking place, and it's in the book of Ruth, the Bible says he took off his shoe. That was the sealing of the deal, was he took off his shoe. I'm not real clear in my mind as to where it was Boaz took off his shoe and gave it to the other man, or whether it was the other man took off his shoe and gave it to Boaz. I rather think that it was the latter, that the other man, the near kinsman, took off his shoe and gave it to Boaz, because it seems to me, you know, that the handing of this shoe would be symbolic of him transferring the responsibility for the redemption of this property from him to Boaz. So it seems to me that the proper way to do that would have been for him to have taken off his shoe and given it to Boaz. Now I can just imagine, as soon as they concluded that conversation, the near kinsman goes his way and Boaz goes his way, and Boaz goes along, you know, carrying that shoe. You know, I can't think of anything that is any more worthless than one used shoe. And yet, when Boaz looked at that shoe, he rejoiced. Because he didn't see a shoe that probably wouldn't fit him. But even if it did fit him, he wouldn't wear it. Might wear it if he had two of them, but just one, he wouldn't wear one by himself because it wouldn't match the shoe he had on his other foot. But that shoe, its value was not how much wear he got out of it. Its value was, when he looked at that shoe, he didn't see a shoe. He saw that woman, Ruth, that shoe represented. And he would look at that shoe and rejoice. Now getting back to the 12 men that had gone through the land, and they brought back this bunch of grapes, but the value of the bunch of grapes was not how good they tasted or how nutritious they were. The value of them was that when you looked at that bunch of grapes, you didn't see, you know, you're part of the bunch of grapes. You saw what the bunch of grapes represented, the glory of the land. Just a little foretaste of it. You know, the little foretaste that I've had of heaven, and that I've tried to declare that to you, but just a little foretaste really of what heaven is. You know, I just saw a little glimpse of it, and then in telling you about it, I lost some of that even. But the value of the foretaste as compared to the real thing is about like the value of that used shoe as compared to the real thing, Ruth. They brought back this word of the land. It's a good land. And heaven is a good place. And you know, there are three heavens mentioned in the Bible. The Bible doesn't point out what the three heavens are, but I think that the first heaven is the way of worship that God gave to the Jews. That the second heaven is the way of worship that we experience today. And then the third heaven is that one that's over yonder that we're all looking forward to going to when our life ends.
Now that first heaven, the meaning of it is in type and shadow. Animal sacrifices.
And we're taught in the Bible that the blood of bulls and goats won't take away sin.
And yet those Jews, as they slew those animals, they had a season of rejoicing. And I would suspect that most of them went away from that experience feeling that the slaying of the animal had taken away their sin.
Well, now we know that the slaying of the animal was just a picture of Jesus giving his life.
So we have an understanding that's better than the Jews did. An understanding that's immeasurably better than theirs was.
You know the comparison about like that you, Shue, and Ruth, whom Boaz loved. You know, as we live here in this life, as we worship, and we have a little glimpse of heaven over yonder, and what we see compares to the real heaven that's over there, and the fullness of it, about like that you, Shue. We just have just a little glimpse of it.
The very highest experience that we have as we live serving God,
the highest experience that we have is just a little foretaste of the real thing that's over there. Oh, we have something to look forward to. Lord, help us that we might realize we have great things in store for us.
Not because we have earned it. Not because of us in any way.
We have it because of what Jesus has done for us. He took away our sin, gave us His righteousness. Oh, I heard a man on the radio this morning talking about things that mean something. He told this little anecdote about the man that decided that when he went to heaven, he wanted to take his worldly riches with him. He was a rich man. And he decided that when he went to heaven, he wanted to take his riches with him. God gave him the privilege. He changed it into pieces of gold, put them all in a suitcase, and when he died, went to heaven carrying that suitcase, got to the gate where St. Peter was. St. Peter said, "What you got?" He opened up the suitcase and showed him these ingots of gold. Peter said, "You mean you brought your bricks with you?" And of course, he then mentioned, we get so wrapped up in the things of the world that we put values on things that are not the real value. And he said, what we ought to be doing instead of working for those things is accumulating those things that have meaning, like the souls we save. That was the illustration he used. Indicating that he thought when we get there, those that have been instrumental in saving a lot of souls are going to have a higher place than them that saved just a few. Of course, I got to wondering, you know, I haven't saved any, so where's that going to leave me? I don't even get in the gate, I reckon. But heaven is a glorious place. It's going to be ours. We'll enjoy the fullness of it. All we're getting now is just a little foretaste of it. There we'll enjoy the fullness of it. Lord, help us that we might spend our lives thinking about that, rejoicing in our hope, but also enjoying the foretaste that we have while we're living here. And then just realizing that as much as we enjoy it, it's just a little foretaste of what's over there. Oh, I have a priest to listen. But the Lord help us to think on it. The Lord help us to serve Him all the days of our lives. We're going to stand and sing a song. And as we sing, we announce the open door of the church. If you're present, you want to live among this people serving God. The invitation is extended as we stand and sing now.